Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and maybe you heard the breaking news report announcing that the journalists who have been trapped in the Rixos Hotel in Tripoli for the past 5 days have now been freed. Also coming across the AP wire last hour, a statement from Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's foreign minister that Gaddafi's grip on power is, quote, over. British broadcaster Channel 4 there is reporting that the foreign minister said that, quote, now I'm not in touch with anybody, so it looks like things have passed this kind of solution, unquote. And while the military campaign has drawn most of the world's attention since it began more than 5 months ago, rebel political leaders have been meeting with Western and regional diplomats to plan their transition to democracy. Here is the Libyan Transitional National Council's ambassador to the U.S. speaking on All Things Considered yesterday about what his country needs from NATO once the military effort concludes.
We need to build our country. We need a democratic institution. We need to train our people. We have to secure our borders. And we need, of course, technology. We need help of personnel. It will be a major development in Libya after the regime's collapse.
That was Ali Suleiman Ojali, the Libyan Transitional National Council's ambassador to the United States. He was also Colonel Gaddafi's ambassador until he left the regime in February. His call for democratic institutions echoes the views of my next guest, Benjamin Barber, the internationally renowned political theorist and distinguished senior fellow at the Policy Center Demos. He was a member of the international board of the Safe Gaddafi International Charity and Development Foundation for a time until he resigned in protest at the start of the Libyan uprising. He's also the author of many books, including Jihad versus McWorld and Strong Democracy. Hey, Ben Barber, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
First, can I get your reaction to the statement from Gaddafi's foreign minister? Does that indicate a measurable change in leadership?
Well, I think it does. I think it probably indicates that for the last 2 or 3 days, the formal institutions of the regime have been disintegrating, and what we now are looking at are individual pockets of resistance, either by individuals still loyal to Gaddafi or perhaps his son Camus or his son Saif, and Gaddafi himself in charge of small units. But I think we're in a transition from a formal regime that is more or less collapsed to what might be a counterinsurgency, an ongoing small-bore resistance to the takeover by the insurgents.
Do you think that the rebels can establish their government without locating Gaddafi if and when they secure the rest of Tripoli?
Well, I think they're going to try. I mean, the danger is, though, this begins to look like Iraq before Saddam Hussein, you know, was captured, which his being at large and Saif Gaddafi, perhaps even more so being at large and maybe some of the other sons, will encourage those who are still loyal to the regime. And we can talk about that, but there are many who are loyal, not so much to the regime, but to Tripoli and to the and who are against the insurgents for their own reasons. They're likely to conduct a low grade but possibly quite violent counterinsurgency, which could involve roadside bombs and suicide bombers and snipers, and create constant fear and constant difficulties for those trying to establish a government. So that's one problem. Is, in other words, how do you deal with the remnants of a regime in a decentralized country where they can make a lot of trouble? But the bigger problem is how the insurgents are going to pull together, even aside from all that, and do anything.
Ben, who are those people who would resist the rebels? If it's not the Gaddafi family or people who are, you know, getting their bread directly from the Gaddafi's largesse, who's opposed to the rebels? What are their reasons?
Well, you see, here's the thing, Brian. There's been so much misinformation about all this. The Gaddafis came to power, Muammar Gaddafi came to power in 1969 to overthrow the rule of the East, the rule of so-called Cyrenaica, which until 1931 was really a country of its own. The monarchy from 1951 to 1969 was based in Benghazi, and for those almost 20 years, you had the rule of the East over the West. And when Gaddafi came into power, he kind of changed the balance, and now you have the rule of Tripoli over the East. And Benghazi has been chafing for the last 40 years, not just because of the tyrant Gaddafi, but because they've been under the rule of the West and they don't like it. One of the reasons Gaddafi reacted so violently to the uprising in Benghazi was it wasn't just a democratic uprising. It was an uprising of the old monarchist forces or those who supported the monarchy for tribal reasons. I mean, remember, there are 140 tribes in Libya. It looks from that point of view much more like Somalia, say, than in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And many of those tribes have their loyalty to the rule of the West, the rule of what was once called Tripolitania, with its capital at Tripoli. Those tribes, with or without Gaddafi, are not going to want to come under the thumb and the force of rule from the East. Now, if the insurgents can really establish a genuine all-Libyan constitution and involve members of those tribes, it could work. But keep in mind, that's exactly what Gaddafi tried to do in 1969. For the first two or three years, he declared he was a Libyan nationalist. He was a contemporary at that time of Nasser and saw himself like Nasser and Castro as a nationalist founder, and he tried to get an all-Libyan regime. He failed. The folks from the East and Benghazi would not cooperate, and within a few years, his regime became, in effect, a Western, a Tripoli regime with lots of the tribes from that area there. So,
do you think things are different enough today that an all-Libya government is more of a possibility?
I don't think so. I mean, my own view is that we're no closer to it. And you said, and you asked me in the beginning, you know, who are the insurgents? And one of the problems is there are 31 members of the Transitional National Council. I have never seen more than 11 or 15 of them identified. The other 15, it has been surmised, may come from the mosques, may come from al-Qaeda or from jihadists. One of the reasons that the military efforts of the rebels became much more effective in the last 4 or 5 weeks wasn't just NATO, but also the return from Afghanistan of jihadists from East Libya, from Benghazi and elsewhere. They had been in Afghanistan killing Americans, and they came back and joined the insurgency. And recently the BBC reported that one ex-Al-Qaeda jihadist who had come from Afghanistan was actually spotting for NATO warplanes, helping a jihadist helping NATO bomb Gaddafi's facilities. So, you know, we don't really know who those folks are.
So you're seriously concerned that there's a serious, that there's a meaningful contingent of Al-Qaeda-type jihadis in the Transitional National Council? That would be more alarm than most experts are sounding about the makeup.
Well, let me put it this way. Nobody's asking questions. I don't know that. I can't claim to know that. I know that the jihadists have been part of the insurgent militias, and I know they have played a role. I know the mosques have played a role. But the media talk only to English speakers for the most part, and the folks from the mosques and the jihadists for the most part aren't English speakers, and they're being kept, you know, with a low profile by the insurgency. But these questions simply aren't being asked. We, you know, they talk about a new national unity in Libya, but 3 weeks ago, Yunus Obaidi, who is the leading general of the insurgent militia, was murdered in Benghazi by other tribesmen who were part of the insurgency. I have never heard, perhaps you have, I haven't heard anyone give an explanation of what happened, who did it. I have seen nobody punished. And yet, you know, here we have them murdering their own commanding general and no resolution of that. And then they're talking about Libyan national unity. Even unity within the insurgents, from my point of view, is going to be very hard to establish, let alone unity between the insurgents and those they have now defeated.
Well, how much is it a good omen that Tripoli was taken these last few days in large part by rebels from Tripoli and Western Libya, not the Eastern Libyans, with the rebellion based in Benghazi?
Well, again, Brian, I just don't have the information. I haven't seen any indication that there were very many serious professional military militias from Tripoli. It's true that folks in the Nufusa Mountains, Berber tribesmen, for example, who played a large role in Zawiya and in freeing some of the Western towns that enabled the militias to get into Tripoli, those are from the West. But again, you see, the problem there is they were allies, like the Kurds were allies, you know, in Iraq. But the Berbers in those mountains are Western Berbers, and they will no more want to be dominated from Benghazi than they were wanting to be dominated from Tripoli. So they allies today could become problems tomorrow. I mean, it's a fractured country. It's a tribal country. There has been longstanding over centuries bad faith, bad will, animosity among these tribes. And I'm not saying that it's impossible, but this isn't Tahrir Square. This isn't Egypt. This isn't tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young men who see themselves as Libyans and who are secularists and so on. It's a very different cup of tea. And it's not that I don't think it's possible that you can get a decent transition. What bothers me is that neither the people on the ground representing the insurgency nor, more importantly, the Western leaders who are going to have to deal with this seem to have an inkling of how tough it's going to be. And if they go into this kind of naive and blind and say, oh, wow, it's Tahrir Square all over again, you know, we're going to have a peaceful transition, and in 6 months we're going to have democracy in Libya, I think they're going to be
not
in a lot of trouble.
Benjamin Barber, political theorist from Demos, my guest on WNYC. We can take some phone calls for him. Libyan Americans want to be more optimistic than he is. Anybody else want to call in with a question or comment? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org or tweet at Brian Lehrer or post it on our Facebook page. And you talked about the West. Where does this leave the United States or the West in general in terms of what options it has to affect the most positive or, let's say, pro-democratic possible outcome?
Well, we might want to, Brian, parse this term, the West, because in this case, Obama actually is looking rather prudent. Even a couple of days ago when they claimed, it was a lie, but they claimed they had captured Saif Gaddafi, you know, he stood back and said, well, it's not over, let's wait and see what's going on. And right now, the United States has taken a, you know, leading from behind, as they call it, position that actually has left us more prudently poised to deal with difficulties. But I think the real problems come from London and Paris and Rome, where there's been this unquestioning faith where the NATO air assaults, which were supposed to protect civilians, quite quickly became the air arm of the rebel forces and basically acted as the rebel air force and killed a lot of civilians on the way to helping the rebels win the day. I think that, you know, I don't see there, and I've been talking a lot to the BBC and interviews and arguing with people from Britain on the BBC, where they seem to just think, is this just a really simple matter? And I don't want to be pessimistic. I think it's beautiful what people throughout the Middle East have done. And I think there are many, many Libyans in Tripoli and Benghazi who really aspire to and want a new democratic start. And that's beautiful, and we should, you know, applaud that. But what bothers me is the naivete in the Western capitals about how much that's going to take. I mean, there's one – I've got a piece I'm about to publish called Democracy Lag. Revolutions happen in a hurry. Democracy happens only over years. And a lot of people seem to think that revolution and democracy are the same thing. When you throw out a tyrant, you don't get democracy, you get chaos. And to go from throwing out a tyrant to getting democracy is a long, hard process. They learned that in 1789 in Paris. They learned that in 1917 in Moscow and Petersburg. And, of course, they learned it even in Iraq, where they overthrew Saddam Hussein, but we still haven't established really an effective and functioning democracy. Many years later, it takes a long time and hard work, and the more fractured the country, the less of a nation there is, the less of a sense of citizenship and civil society there is, the harder it is to do. And my fear throughout the Middle East, but particularly in Libya, is that after a while, what happens is that for a long time, people blame the dictator for all the problems. But when the dictator goes, and then they have a struggle to make democratic institutions, and it doesn't really work very well, they start blaming democracy. This happened after 1989 in Eastern Europe, where Poles and Hungarians began to re-elect the communists they had thrown out earlier because they were disappointed with democracy. They thought it was democracy's fault.
But this is where
they never really did the work it takes to develop democracy.
This is where people...
That's what frightens me.
Where people like you come in, because you're kind of a democracy consultant, even at one point to Saif Gaddafi before he disappointed you and decided that he wasn't going to work for reform but just uphold the regime. So can people like yourself from the West, as well as people from within, work together together to do this in an optimal way? Is there an optimal way?
Well, that's a wonderful point, Brian, and forget whether I can do it or not. There are certainly people on the ground there and so on who understand this and can do it. And as I say, the important thing is that the elites, the policy elites in Washington and London and Paris, give them a chance to do it, that they don't raise expectations too high, that they don't think, this is what happened in Iraq, let's have elections right away before we have citizens. Elections without citizens is always a disaster. You need citizens first, then you can have elections. You need civil society before you can have democratic government, and that takes hard work. And it also takes, you said, together. I would love, one of the things I said over the last 6 months is that the countries in the Arab Spring need to work together. You're not going to get Egypt, you're not going to get democracy in Egypt without democracy in Tunisia, without democracy in Libya. If those people begin to work across borders and try to think of democracy as a region-wide ambition that they can accomplish by working with one another, that's one way to get this work done. The other hard thing, Brian, and this is, it's hard for me even, I understand, these people have been waiting for liberty, waiting for democracy, waiting for participation for generations. And now a guy like me comes along and says, well, you know, it's hard. It's going to take a long time. Be patient. Maybe only your children are going to be free. That may be historically true, but it's not a viable political message. People are impatient. They're angry. They want it now. And one of the questions is, how do you temper the zeal for democracy enough to actually make it work and not disappoint and anger the people who have risked their lives and in some cases given their lives to achieve this opportunity? That's a real dilemma.
But parallel dilemma, the similar dilemma is, do people really want democracy at all if they're not political theorists for a living? It sounds like from the history you're describing, and this would apply to a lot of other countries too, that people want theirs. And so if people from the East felt that the western part of Libya was, you know, had its thumb on them, then they want theirs. They're not hungering for democracy. They're hungering for theirs.
Well, I think the good news is we're multitaskers. I think we can want both. I mean, I don't think it's one or the other. I think people can want freedom for their country and for all citizens, but also say, but I want to make sure I get my fair share. Uh-huh. The problem is those two things sometimes go head-to-head against one another. But a good policy, a good strategy, is to try to get those things to reinforce one another, to understand in Benghazi that Benghazi is not going to get its unless Tripoli can get its goods delivered to it, that the Berbers in the mountains of Nafusa, southwest of Tripoli, are not going to prosper unless Libya does prosper as a whole. That's the beauty of democratic citizenship, as you begin to understand, once you get it, that working together as citizens gets all of you as individuals and groups more than you'd get if you were fighting one another.
Alicia in Northvale, you're on WNYC with Benjamin Barber. Hello.
Okay, hi. Thank you for taking my call. At the risk of sounding like an isolationist, I first want to say that what your guest was saying a little bit earlier in terms of really taking a closer look in terms of who the rebels actually are. I feel like the United States, we as a country, you know, we see this, oh, yay, they're going to put in a democratic country. Let's help them out. Although Libya is a tribal, it is a tribal country, and it is built on something that we here in the United States don't understand. We don't understand a government being taken over by a coup. We don't understand that when your guest is saying there's a, I forget how many various tribes there are, that's not something we culturally understand because our country isn't built on that.
I'm not sure that we could say that, Alicia. That, I mean, our country was established on, you know, after a coup against the King of England, and we have all kinds of factions in this country. Maybe you don't call them tribes in the sense that you use with respect to Libya, but all kinds of factions in this country that are fighting. Look at even the debt ceiling debate. Is that too close a parallel for you, Benjamin Barber?
No, I think it's a very good one, Brian, and I think what your caller is saying quite rightly is that to a large extent we have now succeeded in creating an America to which all of us, whether we're Irish or African-American or Latino or Asian-American, feel we can belong. And we belong not through our origins in these different ethnicities and races. We belong because we share a common citizenship. That common citizenship, as you say, is currently being tried by the political debates in Washington, but the country's not really fracturing along those. But in effect, I think your caller is paying tribute to the fact that we have successfully overcome all the different pasts and countries that we've come from and created something like a sense of what it means to be an American. And all I'm saying is that Egypt and Libya and Syria and every country, Iraq, in search of democracy, has to create that sense of common citizenship, common purpose, common goals, common public goods in order to make democracy work. And that's very hard. After all, we had 80 years in America of slavery. You know, we had anti-immigration things. We tried to stop the Catholics, the Irish. We tried to stop the Jews. Then we tried to stop the Latinos from coming in from 1925 to 1965. There was no real immigration allowed at all into America. So we've had our struggles with it. And I think, you know, the caller's right to say we don't have that problem today very much, but that's because we worked for 200 years to make ourselves one civic nation, one people that we can all be part of. And that's what other countries that want democracy have to do, but that's hard work. It takes a long time, and people don't have the patience.
Alicia, thank you. Call us again. David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. My question for the gentleman is, why did he wait so long to leave the Gaddafi's when they blew 300, almost 400 people out of the air? At that time, I think it was time to...
That was the Pan Am 103 in 1988. You weren't working with the Saif Gaddafi Foundation but...
I didn't start working in the charitable foundation until the period when Libya had relations with the United States, had diplomatic relations with England, when it was working with the CIA against al-Qaeda, and when it had become an ally.
There was that time when the Bush administration was saying, okay, General Gaddafi, because he sees what we're doing to Saddam Hussein, has decided to come in from the cold. Right?
I worked with him when it looked like the Charitable Foundation. If you'd like to look this up, look at some of my writings on it. The work the Charitable Foundation was doing in 2007, 8, and 9 was widely applauded by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, by the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. What happened, however, is that last winter, when the insurgency started, Saif Gaddafi faced a choice. He was actually out of the country. He was not very well. He didn't feel very safe in Tripoli because of his reform work, but he faced the choice of does he go back and join his family, defend his clan, or does he continue to stand for his liberal principles? And kind of like Michael Corleone in The Godfather, you know, he chose for clan and family and against his own convictions, and it was a tragic and terrible choice that he made. By the way, others, there are two people on the National Council, Transitional Council, who are leaders. One is Jalil, the justice minister, and the other is Jibril, the economic minister, now I guess the prime minister of the new regime. They both worked with Saif in government in Libya from 2007 to 2009. They were members of Muammar Gaddafi's cabinet, and they were reformers, and they came into government because of Saif Gaddafi.
So, last
question.
They were
in the same position, but they made the smart decision when the thing started to say, wait a minute, we've got to now be part of the insurgency because Muammar Gaddafi's repressing freedom and not letting it happen. Saif could have made that decision. I wished he had. I urged him to. But he chose blood and family and clan, as I guess a lot of people do in such conflicts, and went to the wrong side.
So last question. Do you know Saif well enough to know if it was close for him and why ultimately he chose blood and clan over his emerging values?
Well, I know him well, and I actually saw him in December right before, and at that time he had moved the meeting of the Gaddafi Foundation from Tripoli to London because he felt it wasn't safe for any of us working with the foundation to be in Tripoli because of possible repression from his father and from the police state. So at that time he was very much himself feeling under threat. But I also know, you know, he has six brothers. He's very much a Libyan and very much a clansman, a tribesman, someone who belongs to his tribe. And I think what happened, as I say, like Michael Corleone, is when it was a choice between abandoning his brothers, his sister, his father, or abandoning his work and principles and, you know, going to Libya, he made that choice. I haven't talked to him since the beginning of the insurgency, so I can't, you know, say he didn't tell me that. There is an old saying, though, in the Middle East and North Africa, family first, tribe second, nation last. And in that sense, he simply followed a sad logic of blood which seems to prevail in that part of the world.
Benjamin Barber, internationally renowned political theorist, distinguished senior fellow at the Policy Center, Demos, and a former member of the International Board of the Safe Gaddafi International Charity and Development Foundation, author of many books, including Jihad versus McWorld and Strong Democracy. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian. Good to talk to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, it's definitely not the DREAM Act, but if you were brought here illegally by your immigrant parents, you can breathe a little easier under a new Obama policy. We'll explain it and get your reactions. And then Gene Rushinoff from the Strap Hangers campaign will join us to take your calls on the state of your subway line. Stay with us.